From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, the reaction to President Obama's speech last night. He says he's putting together a broad coalition to fight Islamic State, not just in Iraq, but in Syria as well.
This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
Also today, the Royal Bank of Scotland says it will leave Scotland if voters choose independence. The latest from South Africa, our man was in court for the beginning of the Pistorius verdict.
Legal experts slightly perplexed at the end of the day in what's been described as a cliffhanger closing.
And remembering an on-screen bad guy, the actor Richard Kiel, Jaws in the James Bond films. That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts with the latest world news. 10 Arab states, a group that includes Saudi Arabia, have expressed their support for America's efforts to crush the threat from Islamic State jihadists. Following regional talks with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, the group of 10 Arab states agreed to help stop funds flowing to Islamic State militants, as well as foreign fighters. The U.S. is appealing to other nations to build an international coalition against ISIS, which controls large sections of Syria and Iraq. But U.S. President Barack Obama has insisted that this is more of a counter-terrorism effort and less of a war. Priscilla Huff reports.
Another 475 U.S. military advisors will be heading to Iraq. And the question for many Americans is this a step toward the inevitable? U.S. soldiers on the ground fighting the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. U.S. President Barack Obama promised there will be no combat forces on the ground in Iraq, but he's also promised to take the fight to wherever the Islamic militants are, and that is likely to include Syria. The challenge is to defeat the Islamic State militants without strengthening the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, something American military officers say has no precedent and will take a long time.
But there's an outlier, and that's Moscow. Russia's warned the U.S. against carrying out airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria, saying it would be a gross violation of international law. Meanwhile, the UK says it's not ruling out military action. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Downing Street says that when Philip Hammond ruled out airstrikes by the UK against IS in Syria, he meant to rule out airstrikes against Syrian government forces. A spokesman for the Prime Minister says the UK is not yet at the stage of making decisions about participation in military action in Iraq or Syria.
The judge in the murder trial of Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius has ruled there was not sufficient evidence to convict him of the intentional or premeditated murder of his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. The judge said Pistorius had acted too hastily and negligently when he fired his gun, which amounted to culpable homicide. Pistorius has maintained he mistook her for an intruder when he shot and killed her in February last year. Gary Alfonso was at the court.
Oscar Pistorius might sleep a little easier knowing he will not be found guilty of murder with intent or premeditated murder, but Judge Tokozile Masipa has already indicated there was enough evidence that Pistorius had acted too hastily and negligently when he fired the shots that killed Reva Steenkamp. So even though he's likely to receive a culpable homicide verdict, the penalty could be harsh given the circumstances. Pistorius sobbed uncontrollably when the judge said she saw no grounds for a murder conviction. She concludes her judgment on Friday morning, but sentencing will likely be at a later date.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Ceremonies have been held in New York and Washington, D.C. to remember the thousands of people who died when hijacked planes crashed into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Nick Harper reports from New York.
As in years gone by, the names of the almost 3,000 people who died were read out. In Washington, D.C., President Obama led the minute silence on the White House lawn. But 13 years on, the mood in New York City has changed. The memorial site now includes the recently opened 9/11 Museum. And with the One World Trade Center building due to open as office space next year, some have argued the area is now less of a sacred site and perhaps more of a tourist attraction and business hub. Nick Harper, New York.
The 45 United Nations peacekeepers, detained for 2 weeks by rebel fighters in the Golan Heights, have been released. Li Ling Tang has this report.
The 45 Fijian peacekeepers from the UN Disengagement Observer Force, or UNDOF, were freed Thursday afternoon, according to the United Nations. Their release comes 2 weeks after they were kidnapped by members of the al-Nusra Front group fighting the Syrian army in the Golan Heights on the Israeli-Syrian border. Li Lingtan, New York.
Protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, have dispersed after attempting to block a major highway, and several dozen were arrested. This comes amid ongoing tension in the St. Louis suburb, since a white police officer shot dead an unarmed black teen last month. Mary McCarthy reports.
The protest came in the wake of the first city council meeting in Ferguson since 18-year-old Michael Brown, an African-American, was killed by a white police officer. The meeting was tense with some calls for the mostly white leaders of the city to step down and with calls for the governor to appoint a special prosecutor in the case. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And that's the latest world news from Feature Story News. I'm Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I can announce that America will lead a broad coalition to roll back this terrorist threat. Our objective is clear. We will degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL through a comprehensive and sustained counterterrorism strategy. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
President Obama making the case last night for expanded military action against Islamic State militants. In his address to the nation, he intimated that U.S. airstrikes will soon begin in Syria, in addition to those already underway against the militants on the Iraqi side of the border. As Secretary of State John Kerry continues to try and build what President Obama said will be a broad coalition of allies and partners, the Russian government said today any military action in Syria would be a gross violation of international law. That sets the stage for confrontation later this month at the United Nations, when the president himself plans to host a Security Council meeting on how to combat the militant scourge. On Capitol Hill today, there was broad support for the president's speech, though John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, asserted that a single speech does not a strategy make. Internationally, there are many questions about what happens next. Ed Luce is the chief U.S. commentator for Britain's Financial Times.
His objective was to persuade Americans and the world that he has a strategy, in his words, to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. Much of the 14-minute address, however, was devoted to what America would not do in that end. There would be no U.S. military boots on foreign soil. There would be no formal declaration of war, this being strictly a counterterrorism operation. And there would be no U.S. detente, it seems, with the regimes in Syria and Iran to unite against their common enemy. In that regard, his address was as much about reassuring Americans it was not about to be sucked into another Middle Eastern quagmire as it was about setting out a strategy to destroy ISIS. So what then is Mr. Obama's strategy? Well, it consists of four elements. First, more US airstrikes in Iraq and new strikes in Syria. Second, more U.S. military support and training to anti-ISIS forces on the ground, including the new Iraqi government and moderate Syrian groups. Third, more intelligence resources in the region, including presumably drones and special forces operations. And finally, more humanitarian aid to the victims of ISIS barbarism. His chief takeaway, however, was that the U.S. would lead through coalition. Other countries would do the fighting. The U.S. would act as the lead strategist. Did this amount to a strategy? Well, it's hard to say. Almost everything Mr. Obama announced is what the U.S. has already been doing and was doing a couple of weeks ago when the president unwisely let slip to the media that he didn't yet have a strategy to defeat ISIS. That slip, of course, earned him a lot of mockery. And critics will say that Wednesday night's Oval Office address was little more than a shopping list of reactive tactics rather than a strategy. Supporters, of course, will say that Mr. Obama laid out a sensible and achievable list of tools to defeat ISIS, in the long term without hyping its threat to the US in the short term. Indeed, Mr. Obama went out of his way to say that ISIS posed no immediate threat to America.
This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
Which of them is right? Well, ultimately time will tell, but assessing this purely as a piece of political theater, it seems unlikely Mr. Obama will win over many of his doubters with tonight's Oval Office address. He announced nothing new, and he very much avoided the Churchillian rhetoric that his detractors had been calling for. As Mr. Obama implied, the struggle against ISIS is likely to go on long after he has left office. It's a fair bet that he will need to flesh out his ISIS strategy considerably more between now and then.
That's Ed Luce, the chief US commentator for the Financial Times. You can read his Washington coverage daily in the newspaper and online at ft.com. This is FSN Reports. In Scotland today, the campaign against independence from the rest of Britain has some renewed momentum, with just a week to go before the territory's historic referendum. The latest polls show the pro-independence camp slipping slightly with 47% of the vote, and a slight majority, 53%, backing continued union with the rest of the British Isles. But polling numbers have been all over the place over the last few days, and neither side is yet popping champagne corks. Indeed, the leaders of Britain's three main political parties abandoned London entirely yesterday and headed to Scotland, urging the territory to reject independence. FSN's Catherine Drew reports.
Millions of people have a stake in the outcome of the Scottish referendum, but perhaps none more so than David Cameron. At a quieter-than-usual Westminster, Alex Stevenson, political editor of the website politics.co.uk, outlined the possibilities for the British Prime Minister.
And the stakes are huge for David Cameron, because if Scotland does vote yes, then he's going to be the Prime Minister. He's going to go down in history as the Prime Minister who was in charge and let this happen.
After months of lagging well behind in opinion polls, the Yes campaign to Scottish independence surged in recent weeks, so much so that the outcome is now too close to call. Amid newspaper headlines that spoke of his desperation, David Cameron headed north to plead his case during an appearance in Edinburgh.
I would be heartbroken if this family of nations that we've put together and that we've done such amazing things together, if this family of nations was torn apart.
The British Prime Minister wanted to highlight that the referendum is not on the popularity of his government.
I think people can feel it's a bit like a general election, that you make a decision and 5 years later you can make another decision. If you're fed up with the effing Tories, give them a kick and then maybe we'll think again. You know, this is totally different. This is a decision about not the next 5 years, it's a decision about the next century.
The leader of the Yes campaign, Alex Salmond, who heads the Scottish National Party, said the appearance of Westminster leaders in Scotland did not worry him.
The reaction in the streets and communities of Scotland sees this as a last gasp piece of desperation from the Westminster establishment.
And some analysts agree that the visit is a high-stakes gamble for David Cameron. Alex Stevenson, again from the website politics.co.uk.
The word Westminster is toxic north of the border. It's at the heart of the nationalist case that they want to get away from these politicians, these elitist leaders in faraway London. And the whole point of independence is to give Scotland the chance to get rid of them. So it's far from clear whether this last-minute dash up north by Britain's leaders in Westminster is actually going to help at all.
Experts say if Scotland votes for independence, David Cameron will face an unprecedented constitutional crisis that ministers in London are only beginning to grapple with. So what started off as a small campaign by pro-independent Scots has now turned into a highly emotional national drama with a great deal at stake, not only for Scotland's partners, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, but for British Prime Minister David Cameron, who is now on a personal campaign to save the Union. Catherine Drew, London.
One of Britain's largest banks has confirmed it will move its headquarters out of Scotland and down to London if Scots vote for independence next week. The news from the Royal Bank of Scotland comes as the economics behind independence are firmly in the spotlight ahead of next Thursday's vote. Nick Beercroft, chairman of Saxo Capital Markets, has been telling FSN's Dan Whitehead just how significant a move this is by RBS, with just days of campaigning to go.
It just shows really the uncertainties that this will plunge Scotland in the event of a yes vote. Already people are withdrawing deposits, people are rewriting property contracts to include exit clauses and renegotiation clauses in the event of a yes vote. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, I think. This really would be a very sad development, I think, in economic terms. I'm not making a political judgment here. I'm just stating what I think were the economic consequences. Just this question of the currency, which there is no real answer to at the moment. They have four choices. You know, either try and form a currency union with the UK. The problem there is that all the political parties have said, no, we won't do that. Alex Salmond is essentially saying that that's a bluff and they'll come round. But then the irony is that if that were to happen, and if it's going to work, then that would entail fiscal and monetary policy being set from Westminster. So what's the point? In some senses, it's self-defeating. Yeah, otherwise, there's a possibility of sterlingisation, just using sterling without the Bank of England's or the government's acquiescence. And then, of course, the Scottish banks wouldn't have a lender of last resort. There's no Bank of England to stand behind the system then. You know, this has been successful in countries such as Panama and Montenegro. But once again, huge downsides there. They could develop a new currency, a new Scottish currency, a new Central Bank of Scotland. But then interest rates would have to be very high, both for personal borrowing and for the country to borrow. This is a new country which would, to start with, have quite a large budget deficit. You know, 14% without oil, maybe 5 or 8% including oil, all of the oil, and that's a diminishing asset, going down to 1 to 2 billion a year revenue in the 2020s. Or finally try and join the euro, and who wants to join the euro? And once again, it's ironically, that would mean ceding certainly monetary and probably fiscal powers to Brussels, to the ECB. I mean, ultimately, that means to Germany. So once again, really very self-defeating.
If Westminster says, no, we can't have Scotland can't have the union and it wants to use sterling, you say there about the backup that the Bank of England provides, is it the case that Scotland will then have to have a pot of billions and billions of pound in reserve, which Alex Salmond hasn't talked about much, and does that then take money away from some of the things that she's promising in an independent Scotland?
No. Where's that going to come from? You know, there would have to be, if you want to balance the budget, there'd have to be a massive austerity programme, large tax rises and or spending cuts, which is going to be very, very unpalatable and painful. So those choices are really all very unpleasant and a source of uncertainty and problems, very much huge problems down the road.
Scotland's largest fund asset manager has said today that an independent Scotland would thrive. It's not all negative news, and of course some of these big British banks are getting the headlines today. But the polls have gone closer and closer to the wire, and no one thought, whatever happens, it was going to be this close in the week before the referendum. So there's clearly some businesses that think, yeah, this can work, we can prosper.
Yeah, let's face it, there may be a period of mayhem. There would be a period of mayhem, much longer than the period between the vote and March 2016, which the S&P envisages as the date by which all negotiations, if you like, with the Rump UK would be concluded. It's going to take 2 or 3 years, probably. But get through that. It's a new state. People have talked about a Singapore analogy, you know, similar size of country. And fine, they could all settle down and in the end work out in that sense.
That's Nick Beercroft, the chairman of Saxo Capital Markets, talking there about Scottish independence with FSN's Dan Whitehead. Next today to South Africa, and high drama in a Pretoria courtroom where the Paralympic star Oscar Pistorius is on trial for murder. The judge in the case started reading her verdict today. She cleared Pistorius of the murder of his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, but, and it is a critical caveat, she adjourned proceedings for the day before indicating whether she will convict Pistorius of the lesser charge of culpable homicide. It still carries some substantial jail time. FSN's Gary Alfonso joins me now from Pretoria. And Gary, it was a dramatic day in court. What were the main developments?
Probably the single biggest development happened late in the day when Judge Thokozile Masipa ruled that Oscar Pistorius was at best guilty of culpable homicide and there was some level of negligence involved in his actions. And that slightly contradicted an earlier verdict in which Judge Masipa said that Oscar Pistorius was not guilty of intentional murder or murder with intent or even premeditated murder, and saying that the state had not proved beyond reasonable doubt that Oscar Pistorius had planned or had even intended to kill Riva Steenkamp or any other person behind that door. So legal experts slightly perplexed at the end of the day in what's been described as a cliffhanger closing to the first part of this verdict being delivered. Earlier in the day, Judge Masipa dismissed witness testimony, saying that many of the witnesses' descriptions were inconsistent with the timeline of the event, saying that the telephonic and technological timeline introduced by witnesses was the actual only evidence that linked Pistorius's version to the events of that evening, and saying that that made Pistorius's version plausible, even though earlier she had said that Pistorius was a bad witness and that in many cases bad witnesses don't necessarily make for guilty witnesses. So at the end of the day, very dramatic events in court that basically got Oscar Pistorius acquitted for murder and premeditated murder, but still facing the rap for culpable homicide.
What was the judge's main reason for removing murder and premeditation from the verdict possibilities? Was the state's case too weak?
It's not that much that the state didn't build a good case, but just saying that ultimately the state did not prove that Oscar Pistorius had an argument with Riva Steenkamp before she was shot, saying the state did not prove that Oscar Pistorius was in a state of mind that he wanted to kill somebody behind that bathroom door. The judge saying that the state did not deliver on many issues and many statements that it made in the case, saying that it will prove that Oscar Pistorius had an argument from the phone records to all other evidence presented by the state. The judge saying that it was inconsistent with the charges of murder or premeditated murder, so saying that there was no intent to murder, and yet at the end of the day saying that there was some kind of negligence involved. Legal experts still, as I was saying earlier, a little bit perplexed, but culpable homicide is at best what Oscar Pistorius can be found guilty of.
The judge has indicated that there are grounds for a culpable homicide verdict. Do you think that is very likely now, and what can Pistorius expect as an outcome?
The judge told the court that what she asked herself is, was Oscar Pistorius's conduct, did it measure up to what the reasonable or average person would have done, saying that in Oscar Pistorius's case, his disability, his fear of crime in South Africa, rampant crime, and also his background, growing up in a house where a mother wielded firearms and carried a firearm with her at all times, those issues she had to take into consideration and make a ruling as to whether or not Oscar Pistorius was a reasonable person or did what reasonable people would do in a case like that. She did say that a reasonable person would have had other options, would have maybe called security, and even though the fight-flight response that was earlier highlighted by the defense, even somebody with a fight response could have had other options, shouted out at the balcony, which might have scared off somebody. And in that case, her rather abrupt ending of the first day's reading of the judgment and verdict brings to mind that perhaps there's been some negotiation behind the scene as to what charge Oscar Pistorius would now accept, and perhaps the second day might be a conclusion of some level of agreement about a verdict, and perhaps even agreement on sanction that Oscar Pistorius and his legal team would be comfortable with. But on the other side, it could also be that the state feels that because she's introduced the issue of negligence late in the day, it does not remove the case of intent, and that the state's appeal might rest on that. So it's going to be a very interesting day on day two of this verdict.
Now, this case has put the South African legal system of no jury under the spotlight. How do you think the post-apartheid judiciary and the justice system has performed given the extraordinary level of global interest in this case?
Well, the jury system was abolished in South Africa in 1964 by the apartheid state, and since then, judges presided over all court cases, judges alone, and unanimously decided the outcomes of court cases for many, many years. In 1994, with the advent of democracy in South Africa, we got a system of judges with two assessors. And very interesting in this case is that if two assessors feel that the case was leaning in a certain way or evidence ruled in a certain way, the judge cannot overrule them. So I think the post-apartheid South African judiciary and justice system has proved to be very effective in this case, where a judge with two assessors has taken this court case to where it is today. But ultimately, many legal experts and even people on the street in South Africa feel that South Africa might be better served with a jury system. And that's certainly something that the justice system in South Africa has been working with or trying to get to that point over the past 10 years and into the next 10 years to get a jury system going, because it is proving to be the most effective system. But in this case, it's the one South Africa has, and it looks like it's done the job for at least this case, and many legal experts saying that the outcome will probably meet the requirements of the family and also of the accused in this case.
FSN's Gary Alfonso in Pretoria. There was sad news today in the world of James Bond. Richard Kiel, who played the metal-toothed villain Jaws in The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, died in Los Angeles last night at the age of 74. 7 feet 2 inches tall, he had an extraordinary career, starting out as a nightclub bouncer, but quickly moving on to act in a variety of television roles, in programmes including The Twilight Zone, Kolchak the Night Stalker, and latterly working alongside Adam Sandler in Happy Gilmore. But it is as Jaws, the indefatigable bad guy, for which Richard Kiel will be best remembered. Sir Roger Moore, who of course played the good guy, James Bond, remembered his friend today.
Oh, he was one of the loveliest, really, I know it sounds ridiculous, but one of the sweetest men. He was very kind, and we never forget the fact that whenever we did an appearance, and I would always make an appeal for UNICEF, that he would back it up and would talk very eloquently. He was a very, very, very bright man. You know, he looked a little extraordinary, and you wouldn't sort of think at first glance that this was one hell of a brain. He was a marvelous, wonderful, warm-hearted man. We did in America for publicity. We toured doing various radios and television programs. I always remember saying to Richard, "What question do you hate most?" And he would always say, "They say, how big were you when you were little?" And it made him laugh, but I think in a way it infuriated him. Oh, he was a delight. He always on time, always knew what he was up to. Of course, he had a physical disability with his height. He was a little heavy for his legs, and he had a problem always getting up. So I think he was an extraordinarily brave man to do what he did. Most people turn out to be. I play heroes, but I'm rotten. He played bad, but was a really good man. I think the only way of summing up for him was he was a big man with an even bigger heart.
Sir Roger Moore speaking there about Richard Kiel on Britain's LBC Radio. And that's FSN Reports for this Thursday. On the programme tomorrow, more from Gary Alfonso in South Africa as Oscar Pistorius learns his fate. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. From Washington, goodbye.